Hope is the thing with feathers that perches in the soul and sings the tune without the words and never stops at all. The poetry of Emily Dickinson. Greetings and happy new year. It's a fresh new day in a new year that has never existed before. Let us meet it this morning as one congregation, one flock, storm-tossed perhaps, feathers ruffled, yes, yet with some songs still in us and with all our gentle, determined hope. Whether you are new here today or have been attending for some time, we welcome you. I'm Angela Herrera, the senior minister. I'm here this morning with our music director, Susan Peck, with lay leader, Raven Reed Starr, and with our fantastic tech team, including technical arts director, Chris Paul as DJ, and a whole crew of volunteers that we couldn't do this without. We're all so glad to be here with you this morning. And now, as we begin this service, Raven and I invite you to join us in the lighting of candles and chalices.
Our chalice lighting words are by Arlanda Bruniola from Lifting Our Voices, number 236.
Flame, friend of our most ancient ancestors.
We kindle you now to make you visible in this time.
Yet in truth, you burn always.
In the unique worth of each person.
In the imagination.
In the turning of the heart to sorrow or joy.
In the call to hope and in the call to justice, burn bright before us.
Burn bright within us.
And now, to lift your spirits right at the top of this brand new year, a most unusual song from the Chalice Choir that we have been saving for today.
We greetings are 6 feet apart. Will your bell before we depart? We've been tested as suggested, careful are we and smart. Oh, do our masks go with our gowns? Do these face shields hide our crowns? We have plenty, 2020, still we head toward David's town. Melchior is now quarantined, stuck in Persia, so it seems. No more travel on a camel till there's a good vaccine. Balthazar has lost his taste, eating food is such a waste. How disquieting now he's dieting, life now is slower paced. Caspar left a caravan, he postponed his stargazing plans. No more roaming Caspar's home, scrubbing his red hands. We've had plenty, 2020, soon we come to David's town.
Hi, we're the staff team at First Unitarian.
Will you join us in the children's affirmation?
We are Unitarian.
Universalists.
We are people of faith.
With open minds.
Loving hearts.
And helping hands.
Are there any kids who want to come in closer for our time for all ages? Come on over. I want to talk about something really powerful today. Hope. It's a brand new year, and we wonder what it will bring. Do you have special hopes for the new year? What are they? I think hope is kind of like this. Can you tell what this is? They are seeds. What do you think these seeds hope to become someday? A cottonwood tree. I'm standing next to the biggest cottonwood I know, near the Rio Grande here in Albuquerque. Here's why a cottonwood seed reminds me of hope. If I took those fluffy seeds home and I put them in a drawer, do you think they would grow into a tree? Nope. They need some other things, like soil and water and light and air. Like the seeds of a majestic tree, our hopes need some other things in order to grow. It starts with imagination. We imagine and daydream about the thing we're hoping for. Then we nurture our hopes. Our hopes need a little work, help, action, and yes, luck in order to come to life, just like cottonwood seeds growing into a big, majestic tree. Here's one important question, though. Do you think we could ever have a big tree like this without first having a tiny seed? Nope. And it's just the same when it comes to our hopes. Every great thing any person ever achieved started out with a tiny little seed of hope that then was nurtured to action. And that is how it grows to life. That is the power of hope. Happy New Year.
I wonder, have very many of you made New Year's resolutions? If so, what are they? Or if you want to make one right now, what would it be? I invite you to put them in the chat so we can see them with you. We're going to leave the chat open for a few minutes. To love more. I see you, Al. Getting vaccinated? Learn how to make a playlist? That's great. New Lego set. Get organized, just keep swimming. Let us all just keep swimming. Be more patient. I love that. Keep on putting them in the box. I wonder, do you have a history of success? Sometimes I think that New Year's resolutions are kind of like other certain kinds of vows in the sense that they set the bar for us, right? And in doing so, even though we might not be perfect, they pull us in a particular direction. The thing about that is one small change in direction over time leads to a vastly different destination, right? So it all adds up. Let's look at some more. Use less paper, finish some projects around the house and garden, adding more structure to retired life. Oh, we've got some volunteer jobs for you, Lynn. Create more than I consume, love it. It's great to see all of you chiming in here. We start out each year with goals and with questions and uncertainty, especially this year, right? We also start out with plenty of wisdom, some of it like deep down within us, maybe still untapped. And while we can't necessarily see into the future to see how these resolutions will turn out or what this year will bring, we can consult with the future to help us uncover some wisdom. Wisdom that might be hidden from us, but right here, right now. And I'll show you what I mean with a guided meditation. So let's go ahead and pause the chat box for a few minutes while we do that. Thank you all for sharing all of those. I'm looking forward to reading them later. I'll read all of them. And I invite you to get comfortable and breathe and close your eyes if you would like and open your mind. Once you've kind of settled yourself, noticed your breathing, and opened your mind. Imagine that you are looking at the outside of a home. It's just the kind of place that you would like to be. You can tell by looking at it that it is cared for with love. In your mind, let yourself take it in. What kind of structure is it? What colors? What surrounds the home? Perhaps a grove of trees, or the beauty of the desert, a garden, or the landscape of the city. What does the air smell and feel like? Notice the windows. Notice the entryway. What does the front door look like? Notice what it's made of. How heavy or light? How beautiful? What kind of handle? As you gaze at the door, you realize where you have arrived. It is a place in your future. Behind those walls is your future self. How far in the future? You've traveled here. Only you know how far you've come. Maybe 1 year, maybe 10, maybe 50. Maybe this is where you'll find your future self here on Earth, or maybe it is a home in the spirit world. Wherever it is, one thing is clear. It is a place of wholeness and peace. It's so welcoming. You know you can't leave without knocking on the door. So you make your way up to it and give it a gentle knock. You hear the sound of someone approaching on the other side. As the door opens, you're briefly struck by the fragrance of this place, which is pleasant, somehow familiar and new at the same time. And then there you are, your future self, looking back at you with smiling eyes, grasping your hands with warmth. This visit was clearly expected. Your mind is flooded with questions, but no words are spoken. You can see the room behind your future self, but what you can't stop taking in is this beautiful, peaceful version of yourself and the unmistakable feeling of being loved by this person. Your future self gestures for you to wait there at the threshold for a moment and retrieves an envelope from within the room. Extending your hand, you receive it. It is light, made of fine paper. Your future self wraps you in a warm embrace, then waves goodbye with a smile and closes the door. You turn and begin to leave. As you do, you open the envelope. You remove the page inside. It's folded once. Opening it, you see one sentence, the exact message you need to receive. What is it? The first thing that came to your mind when you opened the note. We'll continue in silence.
joy and worry, gratitude and sorrow wind through each of our lives, here in this shared space, in this beloved community. We are buoyed by each other's gladness and help to bear each other's burdens. When the music begins, share your joys and then your concerns in the chat bar for us to hold together. If you cannot write in the chat bar today, we still want to know what's going on with you. Contact us at caring@uuabq.org. Now, let us share together what is in our hearts.
All of these loved ones and all of these joys and concerns, we lift up to the great powers of healing, celebration, and renewal known by many names. And I also want to lift up my joy, our joy that today is Susan Peck's 5th anniversary as our music director at First Unitarian. She has brought so much to our congregation, and she has especially brought us together with music in the last year. Let us give thanks for her ministry of music. I see all of the Zoom applause happening over there. And let us also hold Winona Featheroff in the light today as her 95-year-old father, George Featheroff, nears the end of his life. May he and those near to him be at peace. We lift up the name of Norma Ruptier, who died on Christmas Eve. Norma, a compassionate teacher with a generous heart, may light perpetual shine upon her, and we hold her husband, George, in our love. And with Jan Lee, we remember the passing of her good friend, hospice chaplain Martha Frederick, 1 year ago. We acknowledge that many loved ones have died in the last year, that this year has deepened and complicated our mourning, and that those who are gone are never far from our hearts. Their lives have touched ours. They are part of our lives, and they always will be. Will you join me in prayer? This is a prayer for healing. For you, for me, for all of us who enter the world with bodies and hearts made, it seems, some days for breaking. A prayer for the weary, the worried, the ones with a heavy, invisible burden. A prayer for strength, for the healing energies on the inside and the healing energies on the outside to merge and overwhelm all pain and sadness, to make you light in spirit, to bring a glow back to your face and to your heart, to set you on your proper course or open your eyes to it as it was there in front of you all along. And this is a prayer for celebration, for hearts and bodies that were made, it also seems, for joy and for healing. They can be so indomitable, so resilient, so present to the tiniest joys and pleasures, even when so much has been swept away by the world beneath the world, the one in which oceans flood over the land and difficulty and grief break through the thin membrane between what is and what also could be. This is a prayer for the light within you, within us, within the world, to keep us centered, to keep guiding us back to beauty, to keep shining upon the people around us and through the sacred text of our lives in this new year and every year. May it be so. Amen, and peace be with you.
And also with you. Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin spin, traveling in the world of our creation. What we'll see will defy explanation. If you want to view paradise, simply look around and view it. Anything you want to do it. Want to change the world, there's nothing to it. There is no place to go to compare with your imagination. So go there to be free if you truly wish.
reading this morning is God Found God, from God Went to Beauty School by Cynthia Ryland. It was the weirdest thing. God got all religious on himself. He was looking for something to do, so he went to this church in Boston, one of those churches from the 1800s that likes to consider itself old. This always gives God a laugh. And he was all by himself, and it was quiet, like you wouldn't believe. And up to the sky went these beautiful rafters, and all around him were these beautiful stained glass windows, and everyone was praying. All the people in the pictures, all the statues, all the angels in the room were praying. God knew better than to look at any of the crosses. He was still trying to figure all that out. But he knew that he had found a holy place. So he dropped a coin in the building fund box before he went away.
The other day I was telling my husband about a dream I had had. One of those dreams that on the surface is just purely fantastical. It was not a report of real life. And yet it was absolutely true in the sense that it was a perfect metaphor. Have you had dreams like that? What a peculiar thing, don't you think? That when we are asleep, our minds spin stories that can illustrate deeper aspects of our lives. I once shared with you one of my favorite dreams I've ever had. It took place when I was new to First Unitarian and had been the assistant minister here for just 5 months, when, as planned, the senior minister of the time, Christine Robinson, left for sabbatical. With such little experience, I was going to be the minister in charge of this big church for 4 months. Everything went great, but at the time I did feel nervous. And so one night I dreamed that I had taken Christine's place leading a memorial service. I was at the pulpit in our sanctuary, but instead of standing on my little step, I was on top of a 20-foot high wobbling tower of square throw pillows. I was trying to keep my balance while sorting my pages, some of which were missing, of course. Wow, I thought when I woke up, what a perfect metaphor. The dream was right without being literally true. When we are awake in art and music and in literature, we do the same thing, putting our imaginations to work. We are just such imaginative storytelling creatures. And I think this is truly an endearing characteristic of humans. But what gets me about it is, why? What kind of universe births creatures that love stories so much? Like, why did it do that? Why did it make creatures that want things to be meaningful? What does that have to do with anything, right? Sometimes I think about how we and everything around us are expressions of this same vast universe made out of common elements that combine and are somehow mysteriously sparked to life. And looking at it that way, it's as though we are the universe experiencing itself, experiencing awe, love, suffering. And that too is imaginative, isn't it? There's so much we don't have language for. And what we don't have language for, we struggle with, and so we imagine. We don't have language for things like the edge of space. If you just kept traveling and traveling straight out from the earth, how can there be an end? How could there not be one, right? Or what does it mean that the atoms we're made of are themselves made up mostly of space? And in this universe, what came first, right? And from where? Ultimately, all of these questions point to the first religious questions. What are we? And what does this mean? So we imagine. The neuroscientist and neurotheologian, Andrew Newberg, says, the power of myth lies beneath its literal interpretations, in the ability of its universal symbols and themes to connect us with the most essential parts of ourselves in ways that logic and reason alone cannot. Myths, of course, are imaginative stories. I know the word myth has gotten a bad rap in popular culture. It's synonymous with something that's not factual, and we think that's a bad thing. And there are shows like Mythbusters, you know, that kind of reinforce that definition. But in the anthropological and historical sense, myths are stories that may convey profound truths through symbols rather than through facts. Since there are essential parts of us, as Newberg said, that logic and reason alone cannot address, he explains, then it follows that, quote, religions must be based in myth if they are to have anything meaningful to say to us, even if the extraordinary events that myths chronicle never happened and the beings they portray never walked the earth. The lasting myths of past cultures all contain psychological and spiritual truths that resonate with the psyches and spirits of readers today. So our imaginations are essential to religion and spirituality. When I'm asked what I mean by spirituality, I've often spoken of the part of us that's not made up of parts. And I've said that in the most basic sense, if you are alive and you will someday die, and you're capable of contemplating those facts, then you are of a spiritual nature, meaning there's a part of you, a part that is more than the sum of its parts, it seems, that is processing or trying to make sense of your situation. There's one more aspect of spirituality, one that is certainly connected to how we make sense of that situation, and that's the belief or the experience of being one with or ultimately part of something larger than ourselves. That's spirituality. And religion is what happens when we organize ourselves around spirituality and we share rituals and stories, some of which have been handed down from our ancestors. So next time somebody asks you whether Unitarian Universalism is a religion, now you know what to say. Yes, it is. Humans have been religious creatures ever since we began acting like humans. In fact, Neanderthals buried their dead with special objects, suggesting a sense of the sacred or some kind of a belief in the afterlife among them as well. The religious historian Karen Armstrong suggests that Homo sapiens might just as well be called Homo religiosus too. Religion is so natural to humankind. Drawing on studies in neuroscience, Andrew Newberg says that our brains appear to actually be wired for this. Brain scans show that at the moment a person feels a sense of oneness and profound connection with God or the universe, it shows up as a pattern of activity in the brain, or rather as a pattern of reduced activity. You see, there's a part of our brain that tells us where our bodies end and other objects begin. It helps us locate ourselves in the space around us and to navigate rooms without bumping into furniture, usually, or to make our way down the sidewalk without colliding with telephone poles, most days. In other words, it's the part of the brain that perceives our separateness. And when brain scans are done on people experiencing spiritual oneness, that area of the brain, it seems to have gotten out of the way. It stops offering conflicting information. One way to interpret this would be to say, well, that must mean that our feeling of spiritual oneness is a kind of brain activity and not evidence of a higher reality, right? Another way to interpret it would be to say, we're not as separate from everything as our brains usually make us think. And it may well be that those interpretations are not mutually exclusive. In the words of the theologian Sally McFaig, we are not our own. We belong from the cells of our bodies to the finest reactions of our minds, to the intricate, constantly changing cosmos. In Unitarian Universalism, We name that in our first principle as the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. The interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. The world's mystics have been speaking of oneness for a long time, of course. Mystics from diverse religious traditions, Buddhist, Hindu, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, and more, approach the ultimate through the particular stories and rituals of their tradition, but collectively arrive at the sense, irrefutably and profoundly felt by each, that the ultimate, whether called God or Brahma or the cosmos, is beyond the images, personages, and names we give it. It may be experienced simultaneously as something intimate, personal, and caring, and also as being itself, abstract, incomprehensible, and vast. Some scientists have also named a feeling of oneness. Albert Einstein called it the cosmic religious feeling. It reminds me of the time I met somebody at a party who said that he was a postdoctoral research fellow in astrophysics at Harvard. Well, I was the one that asked. Then I asked him what had led him into that field of study. And he replied, "I guess I wanted to figure out where God lives." And I think he meant that honestly, but not literally, right? That's the thing about this oneness. It's rather ineffable. It is hard for people to put into words. And this is also where the line between atheism and theism gets blurry in my experience. Belief in God is one form religion takes, but it's not inherent to religion. And so we have this similar experience of oneness across cultures, religions, disciplines, and eras. And then we have all of the colorful, imaginative images and stories that religious traditions employ to try to point our direction that way. Our images and stories take many forms, any of which may be quite true in the sense that they convey something meaningful and important, whether or not they are rational and empirical. That's what I like about our reading today, God Found God by Cynthia Ryland. In the poem, God walks into a church and gets all religious on himself. He's not sure about the literal veracity of a particular story. God knew better than to look at any of the crosses, she says. He was still trying to figure all that out, but he knew he had found a holy place. Sally McFaig argues that a good theological metaphor is one that evokes both shock and recognition. It's true and not true at the same time. It disorients and reorients. I think this poem's depiction of God is like that. It's shocking and charming. It is clearly not factual, yet conveys something that is perhaps true. Human understandings of the ultimate have always been imaginative. They're like pictures we've painted. Where we get into trouble is when we forget that they are pictures and we begin to think the thing we have conveyed is ultimate reality itself and therefore truer than everyone else's pictures and stories. The Hebrew Bible tries to head off this all too human tendency. In it, the people of Israel are instructed not to try to create any images of God because they might become idols that distract people from the real God. And when Moses asks the real God's name, God simply says something to the effect of, "My name is Being." But we are story creatures, and so before long, God has been depicted in many different ways, not only in the burning bush, but as a storm, a still small voice, a terrifying angel. In one passage of the book of Isaiah, God is described 5 different ways, including as a demolition squad, a safe place for poor people who have no other safe place, the giver of the biggest dinner party you ever heard of, a powerful sea monster who will swallow up death forever, and as a gentle nursemaid who will wipe away every tear from all faces. The trouble begins when we get stuck on one image without discerning its appropriateness for our own time and situation. McFaig's book, Models of God, is about reimagining Christian theology for an ecological nuclear age. And she argues that the all-powerful, king-like image of God, one who's in control of everything, is not the right model of God for our age. In an age in which humans play at extinction through nuclear arms and through wrecking the balance of life on the planet, to believe that God has ultimate say is to fail to take responsibility for what we are and what we have done. Not only that, but a belief in God who is all powerful logically leads to another belief that those in power are favored by that God. Otherwise, how else could they have gotten there? Our imaginations of the divine shape our lives, and in turn, they shape our world. In these services at First Unitarian, we embrace many names and images, as well as namelessness, for that which is ultimate. In the prayers I've shared with you on these Sundays over the years, I have referred to the earth, our mother, who gave us sunrises and sunsets back and forth like the rocking of your grandmother's chair, and life coming and going, rising and falling, droning and beating like ancient music, her song. I have addressed prayers to the spirit of life, the spirit of love, Holy One, our ancestor, and to the ground of being, the mover, the fire, and the place of rest. Sometimes one prayer lists many names for the divine, but just as often, they don't directly address the ultimate at all, but are humanist and seek to acknowledge other truths about our existence, our love, and our longings, often in poetic language. What images or stories make you feel most connected or spiritually moved, inside or outside of church? There's a conversation prompt for your day. What spiritual images or stories resonate for you? I'm going to wrap this sermon up in a minute. But before I do, I want to just pivot for a second and draw your attention to something, which is that 1 month from now, I'll begin a sabbatical. And that means that for 4 months, from February through May, I'll be away. Ministerial sabbaticals are periods of rest and renewal and study. Congregations grant them in recognition that ministry can be pretty all-consuming work. And that periods of renewal are an important part of a long, fruitful ministry, not to mention a well-balanced minister. In our congregation, ministers usually take a 4-month sabbatical every 4 years, and it's now been 6 years since my last full sabbatical. So it's time. And I know our church is in great hands with Bob LaValle, our associate minister. I'm also really excited that because we're going to still be gathering on Zoom for a while, you're going to get to experience some fantastic visiting preachers from all over the country. This is an awesome opportunity to welcome ministers and leaders of color into this virtual pulpit, folks who otherwise would have to travel many, many miles to join us. So you won't want to miss it. And I'm proud of Bob for taking the initiative to shape up our preaching schedule that way. Now, I hope that Bob will not feel like he is standing on a 20-foot high tower of wobbly square pillows. He brings a lot of experience to this, including experience in nonprofit management. And he has been a minister for 2.5 years, not 5 months like I had. But he is still a fairly new minister. And he's only one minister, so I'm going to be counting on you to go easy on him and to support him, just like you did for me when I covered for Christine's sabbaticals. I know our pastoral care team and our staff and our board of directors will also have his back, and that they will all be there for you while I'm gone. And rest assured, if the board and Bob need to reach me for any kind of an emergency, they know I'm just a phone call away.
Our Change for the Future recipient this quarter is Sage. Sage provides support for older LGBT people in the Albuquerque metropolitan area through advocacy, support groups, resource distribution. We counter isolation, fear, and loneliness by creating a caring community of LGBT elders who will look out for each other. You can make an offering online by clicking on the link that we'll put in the chat box. And if you prefer not to give online, you can always simply mail a check to the church and include Change for the Future in the memo line. Now, please let us exercise the enduring power of generosity.
What is generously given is received with gratitude. Thank you so much for your generosity on behalf of the congregation and on behalf of Sage. This formal part of the service is about to come to a close. And as always, we invite you to participate in breakout rooms during our virtual coffee hour afterward. And if you'd like to do that, all you need to do is just stay on the meeting through the postlude and you'll have an opportunity to connect with a small group. And if you'd like a discussion question to get your conversation going, it's the one I mentioned at the end of the sermon today. What images or stories make you feel most connected or spiritually moved inside or outside of the church? And now, as we extinguish these chalices and candles, I offer you these words of benediction. This This is the day we have been given. Let us rejoice and be glad in it. Let us live wisely, love courageously, and bless all whom we are blessed to meet. Go in peace.